I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I remember the first time I discovered a fallout shelter. It was marked by that yellow sign with the black pinwheel. It was in the basement of the school where I used to take violin lessons. It smelled disused, as if in the 1970s no one really expected a nuclear attack anymore. The whole idea of hiding out in that basement until a radiation all clear was kind of ludicrous. But there were the tubs of preserved food and distilled water from the early 60s, just in case of nuclear attack. It's hard to wrap your head around nukes, maybe because the thought of them detonating with that iconic mushroom cloud above your head is so scary and really incomprehensible. Here's the thing, though. No matter how much the world has changed and other threats like terrorism and global warming dominate our fears, nuclear dangers are still with us. But every day there are ordinary people collaborating in extraordinary ways to keep the rest of us safe from those dangers. Over the next few months, we're going to tell the stories of some of those people for a project we're calling the Nuclear Family. And we're going to start with Matthew Bunn of the Managing the Atom Project at Harvard. He is not the first in his family to choose a career in arms control. His father, George Bunn, was instrumental in drafting the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which went into effect in 1970. Matthew Bunn, thanks for being with us. Let's start at the beginning. When did your father first encounter nuclear weapons?
So he was on a ship bobbing around in the Pacific at the end of World War II, which was slated to be part of the invasion of Japan. And he honestly believed that his life was saved by dropping the bomb on Japan.
He never actually got to be part of that invasion. The bomb dropped and he's out on that ship.
Exactly. And so he ended up ferrying people back from the war rather than participating in the war. So he came back to Madison, Wisconsin, where he'd grown up, and became a physics graduate student. And his father gave him a copy of the Acheson Lilienthal report, which laid out a concept for global international control of all aspects of nuclear technology to ensure disarmament. And he thought, well, if we're going to have disarmament, we're going to need treaties. If we're going to have treaties, we're going to need lawyers. So I'll go off to law school. So he went off to law school specifically with the idea of controlling the bomb.
So with all this stuff swirling around your father, would you call what he kind of ended up doing in law, kind of shifting from physics to law, as an awakening?
Absolutely. It was an awakening. And it's actually just personally an odd transition, because he became a physics graduate student because he was so shy that he wanted to have a job where he could be in a lab and not talk to anyone. And then he became a lawyer and international diplomat.
Yeah, where you have to talk to a lot of people.
All the time.
In 1947-48, how many details did the world know about what had happened in Hiroshima, kind of like the destruction? And how much was he aware of that?
It didn't come out instantly, although there were, you know, global news stories literally the days immediately after the bombings. In fact, Bernard Brody, who later became one of the founders of the whole field of nuclear strategy, had been a naval strategist and went to the drugstore to buy the paper the day after Hiroshima, looked at the headline and turned to his wife and said, "Everything I've ever written is obsolete."
Wow. Well, why did he come to that conclusion?
Because one bomb from one plane could destroy an entire city. That was something dramatically different than anything that had come before. It was a new kind of threat to civilization. I mean, after all, we had just, as a world, gone through a war that had killed tens of millions of people. And the notion that our species would now have bombs available to it where a single bomb could destroy an entire city was just terrifying. At one point, years later, Einstein was asked what weapons World War III would be fought with. And he said, "Well, I don't know, but I can tell you what weapons World War IV will be fought with." And the interviewer said, "Well, how on earth would you know that?" He said, "Sticks and stones."
Right. Yeah. So when your father would come home from work, once he started kind of really trying to curb the spread of nuclear weapons, how did those conversations kind of unfold? Like, you know, did he talk about what he was afraid of? Did he talk about what kind of narratives he was concerned about for the future?
Well, to be honest, I was too young when he was doing most of that work to really understand or participate in those conversations. I got involved when I went off to college, and by that time it was the late 70s, and the Cold War was at its peak. The Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan. People were worried about nuclear war. And about that time, the Freeze Movement got moving. And it turned out my father was the only person in Wisconsin who had ever actually negotiated with the Russians about nuclear arms. And so he began getting invitations to give talks all over the place. And he thought to himself, you know, that was the part of my career that was most exciting and fulfilling. I should go back to doing that. Mm. And so late in life, he returned to nuclear weapons and arms control at a time when I was already working on the subject. And very late in his career, he and I ended up working on more or less the same topics.
How did each of your disciplines of study kind of shape how you each entered this business, if we can call it that? I mean, you went to MIT. Were you a scientist?
Well, I started off at MIT with the idea of majoring in physics. Ended up, when I got interested in nuclear weapons, focusing on the intersection between the technology and the policy, and ended up with my degree actually in political science in the end. And I've always focused more on the technology of nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles, and so on, and the policies that are needed to manage the danger. My father, on the other hand, as a lawyer, focused mainly on the treaties and the legal aspects and the sort of international organizations and norms. Toward the end of his career, after the 9/11 attacks, actually even leading up to the 9/11 attacks, both of us had gotten involved in the question of security for nuclear weapons and the materials needed to make them to keep them from falling into terrorist hands. Immediately after 9/11, there was a global international meeting at the International Atomic Energy Agency, where my father and I both spoke on this topic of security for nuclear weapons and materials. And he said at that meeting, if I had known then what I know now about what terrorists could potentially do, I would have tried to make sure that the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty included provisions to require that all of these weapons and materials be secure.
So in that sense, I'm curious, do you feel like you picked up the baton from your father, kind of really looking at, you know, loose nuclear material and the possibility that that might end up in extremist hands?
Well, I think on that topic, he and I came to it at about the same time. And in fact, I think I may have gotten to it first. When the Soviet Union fell apart in 1991, 25 years ago, next month, the reality is that most of their security system fell apart with it. It was designed for a closed society with closed borders, everyone closely watched by the KGB and nuclear workers who had the best of everything Soviet society had to offer. And all of that went away. They literally had, you know, gaping holes and fences at nuclear facilities and highly enriched uranium stored in what you and I would think of as the equivalent of a high school gym locker with a padlock that could be snapped with a bolt cutter from any hardware store. There was one case where the thief who stole kilograms of highly enriched uranium didn't even bother with a bolt cutter. He took an iron rod and just put it, you know, inside the padlock and twisted and just broke the padlock and made the mistake of leaving the broken padlock lying in the snow, which otherwise nobody would have noticed for a long time that the theft had occurred. So I got involved in the early 90s working on with Russia to try to make sure all of this nuclear material was locked down. And my father then got involved in those topics as well. And ultimately, we did, in the entire course of our careers, remarkably, we only wrote one joint article together.
Do you wish you had written more together? Do you think you could have been kind of doubly productive?
Well, I don't know if we could have been doubly productive, but it would have been fun. One of the hilarious incidents was I was at that time the editor of the leading journal in the field, which is called Arms Control Today. And my father and a colleague of his had written an article about who ends up with the legal rights under different treaties for the Soviet Union of all these new states arising out of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And there was a sentence in that article. I read it five times. I could not understand what the heck it said. And I called up my dad and I said, "Dad, what the heck are you trying to say here?" And he said, "Well, we couldn't agree on that one, so we intentionally wrote it so you couldn't understand what it said." I said, "I'm sorry. As editor of this magazine, I am not putting in a sentence that even the author doesn't know what it means. You guys figure out what you want to say or I'm taking it out."
Generally, what was it like working with your father, George Bunn?
Both of my parents had a feeling that you can't waste your life on this planet. You have to not only try to make yourself happy, but try to make the rest of the world a better place than it would have been if you'd never been here. And I think that basic attitude toward life was definitely absorbed by the children.
You've got two daughters. Do they care about nukes as much as you and their grandfather?
Absolutely not. I think I have unfortunately managed to convince both of them that science is a boring thing that Daddy wants us to be interested in.
So today, Matthew Bunn, I Google nuclear. Pretty much any day there are things going on, big, small. And I'm just curious, in the context of the current presidential race where the word nuclear often goes, shall we say, nuclear pretty fast, as in whom do we trust with the nuclear codes? What occurs to you as to where we've evolved to on nukes, and where do we go from here?
Well, I candidly have found the current election quite depressing. One thing is that until very recently, most Americans have largely forgotten about nuclear dangers. Many people thought that the nuclear danger went away when the Cold War went away, and unfortunately, that's not true. We have thousands of nuclear weapons in the world today, thousands of them, in fact, ready for immediate launch. And the next president is going to face some very serious nuclear dangers. We have a very unpredictable dictator in North Korea that now has close to a couple of dozen nuclear weapons, is producing more, testing longer-range ballistic missiles. We have a nuclear deal with Iran, but some of the key provisions only last for a short period of time. And so the next president is going to have to figure out how to use the time that we've bought with that deal. We have an unbelievable crisis in relations with Russia, where there's a real war scare going on today in Moscow. They've just mobilized 40 million people across the country in a civil defense drill. And there's talk on the news about the coming war with the United States. And I think there are very real dangers of inadvertent conflict, whether it be in the Baltics or elsewhere in Europe. We're getting into some serious tensions with China, and we still have the issue of terrorists. Yes, we've taken out Osama bin Laden, but now we have the Islamic State, and we don't have a lot of evidence that they have the kind of focused nuclear weapons effort that al-Qaeda did have. But there are some hints, and if they ever turn to nuclear weapons, they've got more money, more people, more territory under control, more ability to recruit experts globally than al-Qaeda at its best ever had. So I think we need a president with very careful and sober judgment when handling nuclear issues. I look back at the Cuban Missile Crisis, and in the early days, Kennedy's advisors were almost unanimous in saying, you've got to launch airstrikes on Cuba and then invade. And Kennedy pushed back and said, there's got to be another way. Mm. And we now know, as they didn't then, that there were already nuclear weapons in Cuba and that the people there had the physical capability to launch them. And so had we not had a president with really sober judgment, we might not exist as a civilization today.
How do you sleep at night?
Well, the reality is that we've made an immense amount of progress through sensible policies over the years. More than half of all the countries that once had potential nuclear bomb material on their soil have gotten rid of it. We've reduced nuclear weapons by more than 80% around the world. And we've managed to avoid nuclear conflict and put in place sensible arms restraint measures with verification. And bit by bit, we're making those stronger. I've had the experience in my career of, you know, making a suggestion, convincing governments to try to pursue that suggestion and seeing it make the world a safer place. And I really think there's almost nothing more satisfying than that experience. And my father had that experience as well. You know, he was one of the key negotiators, perhaps the most important of the U.S. negotiators, of the most important nuclear arms treaty of all time, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So it's a satisfying life if you can actually make some progress, and I feel like we have.
That was Matthew Bunn of the Managing the Atom Project at Harvard. His father, George Bunn, was an American diplomat and non-proliferation expert.